We're going to kick off a very listener-focused 26th Whistleblowers in this episode with a letter from a district judge in Pittsburgh. Mark Hornick was kind enough to write about how much he enjoyed the podcast. I honestly thought we were getting sued when I saw the envelope. And he talked about all the things about being a basketball official that prepared him to be a federal trial judge. And I know it meant a lot to you, John, because he was from Pittsburgh and knew a lot of the people you knew growing up.
Yeah, you shared the letter with me just a few minutes ago, and I don't know the gentleman, but we do appreciate his letter. And some of the officials that he mentioned there, Dutch Shampled, Jim Hatcher, and especially Harpo Toole, I know all of those guys, and if they helped him along in his officiating, certainly they were good mentors and good guys, yeah.
So I'm Luke DeCock, News and Observer sports columnist, and with me as always, John Clockerty, the Pittsburgh native and Hall of Fame basketball official. And this is a good way, I think, to kick off our 26th episode. As I said, we have several listener questions that we're going to get to, so thank you for everyone for sending them in. But this letter was unsolicited, and I just want to kind of give a little bit of a summary of what the Honorable Judge Hornack said here. The way that officiating prepared him for the bench. He had to be in position at all times, actually has to make a call, express confidence in the decisions he makes, really know the rules. It's not about him, but the people who are in court. And everything that happens in court is public and on the record. And finally, the requirement of having to stay focused and pay attention for long periods of time when it may seem like nothing's happening, because you never know when something important might happen. I'm just going to read from his last paragraph here. Not a perfect analogy, but I know that I have more confidence in fulfilling my judicial role, having had the experiences I had 40 years ago as a basketball official.
I think it's a perfect analogy. The one thing, the bottom line, is that he wants, as a judge, he wants to be fair in his decisions. Every official, sometimes it doesn't look like it, but they want to be fair in their decisions. And all of the things, he has to make tough decisions and, and be responsible for them. But I think that it's great. Everything he points out, you can relate to officiating any sport, football, basketball, whatever. But he was a basketball guy. And again, he had Gordon good mentors. I know those guys, and I know two of them have passed away, but it seems like I would think this judge is a senior citizen right now. I don't think he's a real young guy. I don't know him, but I'm going to call him and talk to him.
Well, you should, because it sounds like you guys probably have a lot more in common than you might think normally.
Right, exactly.
The Pittsburgh connection runs deep. And I think that's something we've talked about a lot on this podcast, the similarities that I see between my role as a sports columnist and your role as a basketball official, and something I joke about with these guys sometimes, and listeners, regular listeners will have heard this before. We do our jobs in public. There's nowhere to hide.
That's right.
We have to take a stand and call it the way we see it. And sometimes we may be wrong, and we have to live with that. And the other part of it, and this is the part you and I like to joke about, is the one thing above everything else that basketball, all officials, and sports columnists have in common. Everyone, and I mean every single person on the planet, thinks they can do the job better.
That's true, especially people that read your columns and fans that sit in the stands. They all think they can do. But Luke, I need to say that we do our podcast because of our relationship, and you have developed a relationship with officials, and they trust that even in your writing, if you think something was not adjudicated fairly, you'll point that out. But you have gained officials' trust, and that happened with me as the supervisor. We got that relationship, and ACC officials don't have ACC officials are skeptical of writers. They're afraid to talk to them, but somehow you've been able to cross over and talk to a Mike Eads or even a Jamie Lucky, and they feel comfortable talking to you. I think that's is certainly a credit to you, and I'm not sure how you did it, but it works.
Well, I appreciate that, but I would just say that, you know, I think in my job, you try to treat everybody with respect and understand where they're coming from, and it doesn't always work that way, but, you know, whether it's basketball officials or, you know, the security guards at PNC who I see all the time, you know, if you acknowledge that people are human and they have feelings and they deserve respect and people, you know, you tend to be able to get along with people, which is funny because I think a lot of people who know me would say I'm kind of a, you know, can be abrasive and loud and you know, get angry about stuff and be passionate. But, you know, I think with most of the people I deal with on a daily basis, whether that's basketball officials or whoever, you know, if you try to be fair and be respectful and understand where they're coming from, you know, you can get along with people. And you know, that extends, and this is more a journalism thing than an officiating thing, but it probably extends to officiating as well. You know, I may write things that people I cover may not like, that the sports information directors may not like, or the coaches may not like, which happens all the time, or players. And I've always, when I was covering the Hurricanes, when I was covering the NHL, I always told players, if I write something you don't like, you know, say something, you know, let's have that discussion rather than you just being angry and simmering about it, because I may not have known something that I should have known, or you may not have known something that I knew, or whatever, or I may have been wrong, or you may have been wrong, you know, but let's have that dialogue and work it out. And I think that's a universal thing. That's not a journalism thing or an officiating thing. And Lord knows I don't always live up to that ideal.
You know, but let me just say, I don't think you are afraid to write something that you have a strong opinion about, whether it may be a football coach who's not living up to what the expectations are, you know, that and things of that sort. But even on an officiating side, I think our guys would be fine with you saying, you know, that game was not so much poorly officiated, but was haphazard, and there looked like there was a lot of tough decisions. And, you know, what you do right, Luke, and I'll leave it at that, because I don't know of another writer that has gained the trust of officiating staff like you have.
Well, I appreciate that, and I could go on talking about this for the rest of our hour. But we have a lot to get to, and I certainly would hasten to add that I owe you a debt of gratitude, you and Brian Kersey and Paul Brazzo, for opening a lot of those doors. That those guys, I mean, obviously some of them you get to know just from being on the road and seeing them around, but generally speaking, it helps to have a rabbi who will vouch for you, and you guys have all been great for me, and I would advise any writers out there who are listening to this to get to know the officiating supervisor and you know, basketball assistant commissioner of the conferences you cover, because they can be more useful than just as sources. They can open doors for you if you know, and that doesn't mean you kowtow to them or
everything
you write they're going to like, but if you do your job, you know, respectfully and fairly and try to be right more than you're wrong, you know, they can open doors for you, and those guys have for me. So, which is an interesting segue to our next listener question. Fascinating to me, the range that this podcast has. I guess that's the nature of the internet. This one comes all the way from Montana.
Wow, yeah.
Alvin Yellow Owl is an NAIA and high school referee, going to work his first state tournament this year. Congratulations, Alvin, on that, and thank you for your question. And he had a question I think a lot of us have about officials on the outside, let alone, you know, an up-and-coming official like he is. Dealing with fans, you know, how do you deal? Now, we talked in the last episode about you having a knife thrown at you.
Mm-hmm.
So, we don't necessarily need to cover the deadly objects, the assault of the deadly weapon. But how would you handle a fan who was crossing the line, and where did you think that line was?
You know, I think it's an excellent question, and we again, both of us appreciate a good question like that, and it's not easy for referees sometimes, because they have the power to eject a fan who's being abrasive, being totally out of line. And so, under the rules, they have that. But again, it's not easy, and there's a fine line because they got a game day manager who they'll call upon to help them make that happen as far as ejecting a fan. But a couple things to our question. I think some you can get a lot of mileage out if this person is in the stands and he's harassing you simply by not being profane, but like, for example, I can't tell you how many times I had heard a fan say, "Clockerty, make sure you don't quit your day job." Okay, so you don't want to respond to everything because fans are going to have those type of comments. And that was a horrible call, ref. You need to take an eye exam or anything that is critical. I think you get more mileage by just ignoring it. And that probably makes that person even more angry that if you don't respond to it. Any response, like I saw a referee that was getting criticized, and he turned his back to the fan and bent down to tie his shoe, and everybody knew what he was doing. and I said to myself, both of the fans are moron, and so is the referee. just ignore it.
Is there a point though where you ever turn around and just maybe like looked at a guy right in the eye and said, enough?
You don't say enough, but you can send a message. Yes, Luke, to ask your question, you look for them, and if they get, again, if they cross the line, crossing the line is they start using profane language, and you know, you hear all this, "Hey ref, you suck," and this and that, and then it gets to be one more thing and one more thing. Then you call the game day manager. Before the game day manager puts that person out of the arena, they will probably find another seat for them somewhere. It's like when and we had a situation that made a lot of really a notable one where Carl Hess ejected Corcioni and Gugliotti, and they were given Hess on every call that he made. They were making a comment, and they were close enough to the floor. Well,
I feel like we need a sound effect every time we bring this up. You know, like the magic word on Pee-wee's Playhouse, where they're thinking, the confetti drops from the ceiling. Yeah, we did it! 26 episodes! We've mentioned this in every single one!
Well, you know, and I'm sure they didn't put Gugliotti and Corcioni out of the arena. They probably find them some other seats. But you know, and then it became, but I want to get back to a game day manager has so much control of that situation.
And this is someone who works for the home team.
Oh, yeah.
Every arena.
Now, he may not, our writer, Al, he may not be in that situation where there's a game day manager, but everybody has he works in AIA, and that may have a game day manager. One more thing, if you see something that you think needs to be taken down, they had, I can remember, J.J. Redick, they had his phone number, his address, and they were putting it up, and I don't know if it was accurate or not, but if you ask the game day manager to take that down, and I had a similar situation. Game day manager may say there's nothing wrong with that, and we're allowing that, and they have the prerogative. Any signs similar to that is under game day manager. I'm making it big. But the last thing I'd say about that is anybody that sells sideline seats to big-time donors that pay money to sit in those seats, all those seats, when sold, come under restrictions. And the people that buy them know what they can do and what they can't do. And that's an easy one. If that person that's sitting in that high-priced seat in any way, he's close enough to make contact, stand up and be right behind an official, that official can have him removed from there real easy.
Here's the reason why I asked the question about enough. Because when I was in college, I sat a couple years right on the sideline. you know, like where in the seats you're talking about.
Yeah.
That was student seating where I went to school in the Palustra. And we would get on everybody pretty hard. We were pretty obnoxious. I freely admit it now. I remember I went back for a Cubs game one summer with my parents, and I was so used to heckling officials. We were sitting down right near home plate, and Eric Gregg, the late Eric Gregg, was the home plate umpire, and I was riding him pretty hard. And my dad finally put his hand on my bicep and said, "Enough," which, ironically enough, is the same thing a referee who was a Ivy League Patriot Northeast type guy. We saw him a lot. He was a little guy, maybe, you know, kind of a red face, had a little bit of a Frank Perdue look to him. I could probably go and figure out who it was, but we'd see him a lot. But he was running down the sideline one night in the Palestra. I said something to him, and he came running back the other way, and I said something to him again. And he was running by the third time, and I was getting ready to say something, and he held up one finger without even looking at me and said, "Enough." And I shut up.
Yeah, he scared you.
Yeah, well, you know, you never expect the reaction, but it worked. And that's why I asked you, because it feels like sometimes a little subtle interaction. But you seem to think that's throwing red meat to the wolves.
You know, the thing that's upsetting sometimes is an adult will be animated and screaming at you, and maybe might not be cussing, but he's basically out of control, showing disrespect, and you look at who he's sitting with, and he's got his children there. And you say to yourself, you know, the only thing that could happen with those young kids is they're going to act just like the parent. And that's really disturbing when you see that, and you say to yourself, you know, what an example. His kids are going to follow suit, and it's just not good.
I hear you. Let me ask you about one tactic I see guys using when we're lucky enough to have seats on the floor. Occasionally I'll see a guy during a timeout, you know, even maybe with his back to the fans, but have a conversation with some of the people or throw the ball to a little kid who's sitting there. Does that stuff work, or is that kind of a thing that should be left to veterans?
No, I think it does work. I think you can put an angry person at ease a little bit. There's some guys that are very good at it. One of the best is today's supervisor, Brian Kersey. Roger Ayers is another one. But then you have some that won't make any conversation with a fan that's sitting on the sideline. But I think that's a good skill to have. It can certainly quiet a person down. But again, I'm thinking about a couple guys that I won't mention that they won't interact with a sideline fan at all. But I think there's some quality, some good stuff to that.
Seems like it's something that you need a little confidence to pull off. It's a skill, as you said, something you can't just try out one night and see how it goes.
Yeah, it doesn't. I have a picture upstairs in my office of Brian Kersey talking to President Obama, who was at one of the games in Washington. And as Brian's walking over to him, because Brian's not afraid to approach anybody, as Brian's walking over to him, you can see in the background in the picture two Secret Service guys, very serious, very serious, looking down at Brian saying, you know, "You've gone far enough. Don't get too close to the president."
I remember when Obama, after he was president, was at the Zion shoe game last year, the Duke UNC game.
Is that right?
And he was there. Well, yeah, he had the best line of anybody. Yeah. If you watch the clips, they show Obama and he points and he says, "His shoe broke."
Yeah.
He had it right.
Yeah.
But I remember all three guys who worked that game, and they were ACC, you know, regular guys, all went over and shook his hand at one point and talked to him a little bit. So.
Well, Obama would be one guy that would be. President Obama would be a guy that you'd want to go over and shake his hand.
Did you ever have to throw? We may have covered this, and I can't remember, but it's apropos again. Did you ever have to throw someone out of a building? Did you ever eject a fan?
Yeah, I don't remember the exact situation.
Did it happen a lot, I guess?
Oh, no, it never happened a lot. And again, you're pointing at the person that has really crossed the line that you've identified him throwing something on the floor, making obscene remarks, then you point at him, and then you stop playing. You're going to do that at a dead ball anyway. Then you call the game day manager over. He'll come, and you'll say, that person right there needs to be removed. And that's happened not only with me refereeing, but with my crew members and other members. That's how they would handle it. They want to make sure they identify. And you know what? They got – I can't remember the situation – but they got the wrong person one time, and it got embarrassing, and it was it was at Virginia. Oh, I hope I can tell this story. A ball was thrown out on the floor that hit Dick Paparo. And ball bounced into the stands. Paparo is looking around at it for it. And next thing you know, it comes out and it hits him.
This is the game ball.
Game ball. But okay. But it's only a few feet. It wasn't whacked him in the head or anything. And he turned around and there was a woman, and he had the woman removed. The woman was mortified. She didn't do anything. And it got to be a really bad situation for the league. And... for Paparo, because he had this, and she was embarrassed, and it came to find out she was an important person, had a sideline seat at Virginia, and she may have been a politician's wife or something. I don't know. I'm not exactly sure.
But not someone you'd want to cross,
no,
necessarily.
Good point. And it got to be. So you got to be very careful. You can't pick out the wrong one.
Anything you want to add on dealing with fans before we move on?
No, I'd go back to my original is stay calm, accept some of the criticism or the comments, not so much criticism, but the comments coming from fans. If they're not so bad where they're continuous or, real abrasive, just deal with it. I think you get a lot of mileage out of ignoring it, unless it gets really ugly.
Okay. Well, thank you, Alvin, for the question. Hope that helped a little bit. Best of luck in the state tournament. Our next question comes from Justin Finger, who's a soccer official but a basketball fan, or has been a soccer official in the past. He was curious about end-of-game reviews. What are the things that can be reviewed at the end of the game now that you didn't used to be able to review? And a bigger question, sort of what should be reviewable? And I think we can get to that second part next because you and I have differing opinions. But, we now look at goaltending at the end of games. You can look at out-of-bounds plays. You can look at blocked charges in the circle. What's changed over the last, your final year as a supervisor to review at the end of games, and how does that mechanic work?
Well, they keep expanding the review, and they keep adding one more thing to it almost every year. We started out some simple things about whether he was behind the three-point line or inside the three-point line, which I thought was good because you can't award a basket. They added down the line where if the ball's tipped out of bounds in the last minute or two, I can't remember exactly, but you can go review that because it comes down to limited possessions and you want to make sure that the team, those are very hard calls sometimes. They stay at that monitor for a long period of time to make sure they have it right because it comes down to a possession or two. And now I think you always had, the first one they had, Luke, was you want to make sure that the shot got off in time.
Right.
And how much time is remaining, whether the clock stopped correctly when the ball went through the hoop. So all of those are good. But I think there comes a time or a place where what's next and are we taking it too far? I don't know what the committee is looking at, but one that's really good and they put in when I was the supervisor, if you've called a foul and there was a question about reporting it. Who they'll replay that and make sure they've got the right free throw shooter. Two of the finest referees didn't use that and got sent home from the NCAAs. John Higgins and Doug Shouse had the wrong free throw shooter. You want to make sure that the right guy, because not only that, maybe a team might put a guy there that doesn't belong there to shoot the free throws. But I don't, you know, I don't know what the next will be. I watched the game NC State yesterday. No, maybe it was a highlight, halftime highlight, where a ball was blocked and it was a fine line whether it had hit the backboard. There was one time that if you hit the backboard and it was above the cylinder, that was basket interference. Now, anytime a ball hits the backboard, any part of it, that's reviewable. And those plays are hard. So I can't think of one review that doesn't help the game, Luke, but how many reviews? It gets to be where it becomes an irritant to the fans that there's so many reviews.
100%.
Okay. And you're sitting there, and then they want to get it right, so they may take a look at it and
Then you've got the issue where they're not seeing the television feed. They can only see what the video replay manager sitting courtside has grabbed for them. So they don't necessarily have every replay that the television truck has, because that's not the way the DV sports system is set up. Am I right about that?
That is correct. And not only that, our most experienced guys, if they can't get everything they need, they have every right and approval to go across the floor and see what the audience, and to see if the ESPN monitors have something different. Okay, so everything's open to them, but let's get back to the original question. Have we taken it too far, and are there too many visits to the scores table? I think there are some referees that love going over there because they get to be on television and highlighted. And, I'm in front of the camera for 2 or 3 minutes. I ask our guys, get over there, get a good look at it, and let's get the game started. When I was a supervisor, and Paul Brezza would tell you this, we had a situation, and Paul turned around at me. We were in our ACC tournament. He said, "You tell those guys to get going, get this game going." I mean, he was my boss, and he's telling me, "Get these guys going. Yeah. They're spending too much time." And
absolutely correct.
Tell me. I mean, you go to a lot of games. How do you feel about
it? I hate it. You know that. I hate instant replay.
I know, but our audience doesn't know yet.
Anyone who's listened to more than this episode knows that. Yeah, I think there's some value in sort of the where we were a couple years ago in terms of, did he get the shot off? You know, was it a three-pointer? I think we've gone too far. Like, the out-of-bounds play, to me, is a perfect example. The deflected ball out-of-bounds, who'd it go off of? I don't think that should be reviewable, and here's why. When you start reviewing these things, and we've talked about this, and you're the ball, you're teammate, you've got the ball, and I reach in and I knock it away from you, and the ball goes out of bounds. That should be your ball. But we go on replay and we spend 38 minutes going back and forth frame to frame with a little Xbox controller. And what do we end up with? Oh, well, you knocked the ball out of my hands. It grazed my fingertip my finger moved, and your ball, and you're rewarded for a play where I'm supposed to have the ball. You knock it out of bounds, but because it grazed me going out of bounds, the letter of the law, it's your ball. That's not how it's supposed to be. The basket interference stuff, did the ball hit the rim? I think those are more debatable, like the Duke UCF game in the NCAA tournament last year. You know, did that shot hit the rim? Was it a 30-second violation? You know, you couldn't.
Yeah,
it looked different from two different replays. On one replay, it clearly didn't touch the rim. On another replay, it clearly touched the rim. So what do you know? Why are we reviewing that stuff? Let's just trust the guys we're paying to make these decisions. Live with their mistakes. Mm-hmm. Maybe the end of the game, that we know, did time expire? We'll review that. Fine. you know, maybe a three-pointer, you know, something you can go back and look at the next TV timeout. That's great. Like, I love the little spin your finger in the air. Like, let's not stop the game to check if the guy's foot was on the line. We'll go get it, and we'll fix it. That's good. That, to me, is good. The rest of the stuff I can do with that. Yeah, I think it's I think it's really hurting sports.
But let me ask you this. That you make a good argument, but how about this, Luke? Let's say that it's clear off Team A. Bang. And the official, I mean, it's questionable, but it's off Team A, and he gives it to B.
Well, I think the mechanism
Now you've got to come back and say, you know, I need to review this, and I missed it. It's not one of those fingertip jobs. It's that he made a mistake, and Team B needs to have this possession.
You see other officials overrule those calls all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You got two other guys on the court or women on the court. Trust their eyes, too. And, you know, people ask for help all the time. Ask for help. What my argument here is, and not to get off track, we have – at least from my perspective, mechanisms in place to deal with some of these things. And yet we're using a nuclear bomb to plow a field. Like, let's just deal with it. These things all even out in the end. And we're creating problems that weren't there before with some of this stuff. That's my argument.
Well, this is a good subject to talk about, because last night's game came down to a play that was really interesting, in which there was some... For people that watched the NC State, Boston College, there was a scramble on the ball, and we're under 30 seconds. And as a Boston College player went to retrieve the ball, he tipped it back in play and then went in and got the ball. He tipped it. He retrieved it. He sent it forward for an easy two. Now, that is not who touched. They have no chance to review if that player was on the line when he tipped the ball, if you follow me.
Because it wasn't a dead ball?
Because it wasn't a question who hit the ball last going out of bounds.
Okay? You can't review whether or not a player stepped out
of the line.
Okay.
You can't. And do you want to expand the monitor? But I'm not sure they could have seen that. But I think there was a question whether was he on the line when he tipped the ball. Did he tip the ball, then stepped on the line? And is he allowed to come back in play and be the first to touch it?
So just to clarify, after he tips the ball forward, he definitely then, after he's no longer in contact with the ball, steps out of bounds.
Right.
He then steps back into the court and touches the ball again.
He's allowed to do that.
Right. So that was the other question people had, was he reestablishes himself on the court.
Legal,
both feet, and he's, I don't know if there's a basketball move you have to make, but he gets both feet back on the court, and then he touches the ball.
Bottom line is that play is not reviewable, okay? He could have very well.
Well, and thank God.
He could have been very well
because
on the line.
Yeah, it's just something that.
Here's the other part.
Let's just live with it and move on.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
The coach is trying to call timeout.
There was there's the third aspect of this.
And I saw him.
Was there a dead ball where he could call timeout?
There was not a dead ball. He can call a timeout during a live ball situation. If his players are, I need to be careful about that. If there was a violation about to occur, these guys were trying to tie it up. But you can't ask them. Of course, I'm so biased, but you can't ask three referees to referee players on the floor, ball going out of bounds, all this activity, and a coach is going, I need a timeout. You have to award a timeout. You have to see that coach, and you can't take your eyes off the play.
We got to look up the rule on when coaches can call a live ball timeout.
Yeah, I'd have to go back.
I apologize, but
it's been a while, and I'd have to go back. You think it's got to be a dead ball?
Yeah, well, I know coaches can only call a timeout on a dead ball through most of the game. My question is, can they in the final minute? I don't think they can. You know, like, is it a final? I don't think they can anymore. I'm 99% certain the player has to call. Now, if it's a tied ball situation, and even then the player has to call timeout unless there's a whistle. But I may be wrong about that. I don't want to state.
No, and what I'll do is, when we're done, I'll find out an answer and have it for the audience.
There may be a something I'm overlooking or forgetting, that a coach can call a live ball timeout late in games. I don't want to state this unequivocally. But there were, you know, so, you know, when you could, though, I think it was either 2013 or 2014, UNC lost a game because the official didn't see Roy trying to.
No, I remember.
Now, they might have lost anyway.
Yeah, I remember.
But it was an NCAA tournament game in San Antonio.
Right, absolutely.
And they had the ball down against Iowa State on the last possession of the game. And UNC inbounded the ball and ran up court because Roy doesn't like to call timeout in those situations.
Right.
But he wanted the timeout there. Mm-hmm. And nobody was looking at him because he never calls timeout there.
I remember it clearly, and I could tell you who the referee was.
Yeah, I remember too. I don't want to call him out because I don't necessarily think it's his fault there. He's trying to hustle up court.
No, yeah.
But that was, you know, that was frustrating for Roy, the one time he really wanted a timeout. He couldn't get one.
Yeah. It'd be interesting. I need to now I'm really puzzled to see if you could have recognized that timeout. I got to think that you could, even though it was a live ball and both teams were going after it, if – Kevin Keats thought his player had the ball on the floor at that point in time, one of the timeout, I think you could award it. But okay. I want to make sure.
We'll take a look. Related but different, Jay Hemphill sent this in on Twitter, and it was regarding the NC State-Boston College thing. Would we be better off, this is his question, essentially, not verbatim, would we be better off, instead of automatically reviewing all this stuff, giving each coach a challenge where they can challenge a play, and then if they get it wrong, it's a technical foul. This would be sort of the hockey model. In hockey, you can challenge offsides, you can challenge goaltender interference, you can challenge these plays if you think the officials got it wrong, and force a replay review. And if you're wrong, it's a 2-minute penalty.
Yeah, well, they have coaches have a challenge now. And it's not a technical foul. I don't know exactly all the plays they could challenge, but they could challenge a play, and if they are not correct on their challenge, they lose their timeout.
Right. No, but I think the question would be, instead of automatically replaying, going to the monitor. So like the UNC Duke game where we went to the monitor 5 times in the last 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of that, letting the coaches choose when it's important enough to do that.
To look at it.
You know, putting the control in their hands.
And if he's wrong?
The other team shoots free throws.
Free throws. Ooh. Then you'd be certainly prudent on whether you want to make that challenge or not. It's an idea, but
maybe you limit the things that a referee can look at on his own to 3-point shots and clock issues, shot clock violations, game clock, and let the coaches each have 2 challenges on out-of-bounds plays, block charge, things like that. And then we don't have or even clock issues. Mm-hmm. And then we don't have – I mean, maybe sort of did the clock start or not, you can't do as a challenge because otherwise a home timekeeper could use up all the visiting coaches' challenges. And I feel like, and you may disagree, I feel like we've had fewer of those issues since precision time became ubiquitous. I feel like we have fewer of did the clock start or didn't it issues. And precision time, for people who don't know, in almost all games now, not all, but almost all games, and now the NCAA tournament as well, officials wear a small microphone and have a little belt pack that looks like a beeper, and that connects their whistle and then a button on the belt pack to the actual game clock and shot clock. So they control when the clock starts and the clock stops when the microphone picks up a whistle. So that's taken away a lot of the issues we used to have in terms of the clock starting and clock not starting, or clock starting late, or clock running after a whistle, and when does the clock stop? Is it when the ball goes out of bounds, or... You know, because you can't really review when a whistle was. So that's solved a lot of those problems. The ACC, I think, I'm pretty sure, was the first conference to use
it. We were the first conference to use it, and we had a lot of problems. I think the software, maybe the hardware, has all been upgraded. We have fewer problems now. My officials did not like it.
Really?
They did not like it. They felt like if we are able to review all plays that involve whether the clock was started correctly or not caught, not started at the proper time, we can go to the monitor and review that and make sure that we have the right time. And then the bulkiness of the wire coming up through their shirt attached to the microphone. And I had one referee that he was having problems with the microphone and his timing pack. We took it to the manufacturer, and they says that the sweat was clogging up his microphone. It was just one simple thing like that. But then I visited with the commissioner, and he asked, he was very, Commissioner Swoffer says, John, are there more pluses, many more pluses to having it than the few negatives of not having it? And he knew that the pluses outweighed all the negatives.
They've worked most of that out now, haven't
they? Yeah, there's very few, but you're right. But they will still look like... they'll still look.
There's times it doesn't work, but I feel like it has removed
it has.
The vast majority of the did the clock stop when the ball went out of bounds, or did the clock stop when the ball went through the rim, and those kind of things.
Like everything, I think the manufacturers, people that put it together, have upgraded it and worked out a lot of the problems.
So what's your verdict on should replays, most replays, be limited to a coach's challenge?
Oh, Luke, I don't know. I don't think we should get a coach involved in challenging the replays. They have enough situations now where everything's going to be adjudicated properly as far as time, the awarding the points, and my only concern is I'm not downplaying the coach's challenge, but I just got some reservations about how far we can take these to looking at the monitor. This is not related to us, but they put a monitor review on interference football, offense or defensive pass interference. They took a knee-jerk reaction because of the Los Angeles and the New Orleans game, and talking to a few football people that I know says that should have never happened.
No, it was. I hate that. I do.
That should have never happened.
Look at football. There was a period of time where it seemed like football spent the entire game with the guy under the hood, and they've got it now. Coaches get a couple challenges. Mm-hmm. Everything in the last 2 minutes, changes of possession, scoring plays. So you know what will and won't be reviewed. They do it quickly and fast. They don't drag the guy over the hood as often anymore. You know, a scoring play gets automatically reviewed. They do it centralized. Like, that, some of that, like, it speeds up the game. This parade of trips to the monitor, like, it's got to stop. And look.
We both feel the same way about that.
I understand the appeal and the need and the urge to get it right. And if I'm out there, I'm probably going to want to go to the monitor and make sure we got it right. And I'm sure there's coaches who would rather have a procession of the monitor than not if it means things go right. But we're trying to find ways in every sport, in football, in hockey, in basketball, in every sport. How can we make this game more appealing to fans? How can we make it a better experience in the building so people don't just stay home and watch on TV? Because it's better when there's people in the building.
Sure.
And let me tell you, that UNC Duke game was amazing.
Oh,
and
yes.
And the only thing about it that sucked
was the reviews.
Was how much it was just, it just dragged on. And I think by the fifth one, I tweeted, for the love of God, let's go. Enough. Like,
that's what Brazzo said to me. Get these guys going.
See, that's why we get along. Get these guys. Next time I'll say, get these guys going.
Yeah.
So anyway, I love the idea of a coach's challenge. I think, we're getting to the point soon where there's going to be more technology on the bench. The NCAA is moving in that direction. You're going to be allowed to have an iPad on the bench, maybe access to a little video. We're getting to that point soon. In the NHL, look, there's iPads in little racks behind the bench. So if there's an offsides play and the head coach wants to look at it, he grabs the iPad and his video guy down under the stand sends it right to him. So you can do these things quickly, efficiently. You know, the NHL had a ton of these stupid reviews, and now they're typically high leverage plays that a coach thinks they got wrong and is willing to risk a penalty to get right. And if you get to that point, then it's probably something worth reviewing. So I like it. I think it would be good. I think it works in football. I think you could adopt more of an NFL model where certain plays are reviewable and certain plays require a challenge. But, you know, I understand that that's not the way the people in power in the game of college basketball feel.
You know, we're talking about basketball, but I maybe go to one football game a year. And, Luke, when you are in the stadium, you are wondering how they could ever get any momentum at all. There are so many interruptions. I mean, a team scores, okay, and that after the extra point, they go for a break. Then they come back and kick off, and after they catch the ball, it goes for another break, and you're sitting there, are they ever going to play?
Well, how else, John, are we ever going to find out about Night Hero binoculars on the ACC network?
Yeah, I hear you.
And the foot massager.
Yeah, right. And how much money they bring in.
We need to get those ad inventory slots so we can get the reduce the glare glasses. College football especially with the 78-minute halftimes they have. It drags on. NFL game actually, and I've done more NFL lately. When you're there in person, it actually moves pretty quick.
Mm.
You know, you still have the same TV timeout, same procession of TV timeouts, and you occasionally get that score, wait, kick, wait, procession. But for the most part, you know, the halftimes are short. The commercial breaks are, you know, they're not as long as college football commercial. You know, that college football playoff game, you know, it was like a Final Four game that lasted 6 hours with the long commercial breaks and the extra commercial breaks. And it just, like, that game started at 2 in the afternoon and ended at 4 a.m. the next day. Or at least it felt that way. I agree with you, especially in the stadium for a college football game now, it feels like there's more downtime than uptime.
No question.
So let's not let college basketball get there, John.
Well, it's close. And again, I go back. There's some guys that'll review a play and take too much time over there. They need to make a decision and let's go.
I agree with that part. We're on the same page.
They're just staying over there far too long.
That wraps up the interactive portion of this podcast. Thank you to Judge Hornack and Alvin Yellow Owl and Justin Finger and Jay Hempel for your questions. And please, if you have questions or things or video you want us to look at Luke Decock on Twitter, LukeDecock, LDecock, LDecock, at newsobserver.com. As I said, we're happy to take a look, and we'll post the video so everyone can see it, and we'll take on any questions. This just happened to sort of be an empty the mailbag type of podcast. But John, you had one or two things you wanted to wrap up with here before we get going.
I would encourage anybody that father, mother, that they've got any children that show some interest in sports and officiating, if they're not participating, don't overlook the fact that officiating is a very good advocation for anybody. And they are such a decline in officiating in every sport, in every state, that they just need officials and people are pushing away from officiating because of fan interaction, parents, mostly fans, even coaches. There's no young people getting involved in officiating anymore. And every state needs officials, whether it's for soccer or volleyball or basketball or football. Pennsylvania has put in for football that each school has to play one time a year, either on a Thursday night or on a Saturday. Not everybody can play on a Friday because they can't satisfy enough officials. I don't want to keep going on, but if there's a place for officials, for somebody that may want to be involved in athletics and as an advocation. I would, and not only that, you can rise pretty quickly. If you've got some talent and you understand the rules, you learn some skills, communication skills, you can move up pretty quick, and then one thing can lead to another. But right now, there's been a trend. Every year, it seems like fewer and fewer and fewer people are, and this includes young ladies. They can get involved in officiating. There's a real spot for them, but there just seem to be a real decline in officiating, and that's too bad, because the schools are the ones that are suffering. They don't have enough officials.
And I'll just say, I'm not an official, obviously, but I've seen some of the growth opportunities that are out there. You know, a lot of officials who were at your level or are at the level you are at now hold different levels of camps and seminars and two-day clinics where you can really pick up a lot and move along quickly. I spent a couple of summers ago, spent a day in Lynchburg with at the EADS and AIRS camp, mm-hmm. which was not for elite-level officials. It was for people who had a little experience but were just sort of moving their way up, guys who had just started working high school, and women who had just started working high school or were working Division III, were working NAIA, who were junior college, who were just kind of looking to move up the ladder and just didn't necessarily need the basics, but sort of intermediate adjustments. A lot of the things that we talk about, you know, this was just a place where you could work some high school games in the summer, get some feedback from ACC officials, and absorb sort of the way they do things. And I just, as an observer for that day, I sat in on one of the seminars and I watched a bunch of games and I listened to some of the evaluations and I talked to a lot of the guys who were there about, you know, why they were there and where they were trying to get to. And a lot of them were guys who never wanted to work anything other than high school. You know,
right.
They were,
oh, no.
But
yeah.
They wanted to get better.
Sure.
And there are opportunities like that out there. You know, if you're interested in doing this, and I'm probably probably a hair old to get started, but if you and I had gotten to know each other at a younger age, you know, maybe I'd go give basketball a hack.
Sure.
and take it, because, you know, I've seen where some of these guys have come from and how quickly they've come along, and I'm not saying I'd be any good at it, but if I were, there are opportunities to move up. Now, there's some guy listening to this right now who says, I busted my butt for 10 years and can't get, and it does, there's no question it narrows at the top of the funnel in everything. And that, you know, you may be really good and not get the opportunity. Lord knows that's true in journalism. But, you know, I do think if it's something that vaguely interests you, you know, what you say, John, is absolutely true. Give it a shot. See what happens. Because the need is so strong.
You know, Luke, for the person you just said that I busted my tail, never could get ahead, then you got the guy like Mr. Owl, who's been 7 years, he's got the state tournament now, he's working NAIA basketball, and there's a lot of those guys, too, that says, you know, I'm going to hang in here and get a little bit better and get a little bit better. And the thing that's so important is, for a guy like this or anybody, is availability. Because if you are available and your supervisor calls you and say, I had a cancellation, can you go, and you have availability, that goes a long way with a supervisor. So back to my original, you know, give it a shot. Officiating could satisfy your need to stay involved in sports and athletics. And I just think that we always have room for good officials.
What would be the best place for someone to go if they just wanted to learn about where their high or high school association
yeah,
is?
Yeah, you go to the North Carolina High School Athletic Association, which is over in Chapel Hill, their office over in Chapel Hill, and you ask the same question you ask, how do I get involved? And they'll say, where do you live? And here is the guy that's going to conduct the clinics.
And is that true in any state?
In any state. If you go to the WPIAL, is Western Pennsylvania, you can get that information. And go to the PIAA, Pennsylvania Intercollegiate Athletic Association. They'll tell you, go back to Western Pennsylvania, get the information, and they'll direct you. Q Tucker's group will tell you, anybody in North Carolina, exactly. If you live over in the West Coast or East Coast, they have people and conduct clinics and they'll get you in the right direction.
And some of these supervisors, these local slash regional supervisors, they could be a little famous. Like, I know the guy for Fayetteville and that part of North Carolina. He's a former ACC guy who's in the NFL now.
He's in the NFL.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So you may, you know, just by getting started, get some exposure to people who are at the very upper levels. How did you first start?
Originally, I started in college refereeing intramural games and found out that, you know, I enjoyed it. And I made a few bucks, not a lot, obviously, but I made a few bucks. And then, Luke, and then I took a state examination in Ohio because I wanted to. I was going to graduate school, and I thought if I get my license, I might be able to do some high school games. So I took the state examination, and then was a federal exam by the federation, and it took me. Then I went to Wake Forest to teach. I carried that registration, that license, and I start refereeing. And you know, it was harder. I really believed it was harder to move up. But now, with all, like you mentioned, the camps, you get identified. If you find a camp to go to, a lot of people conduct these camps now, and they're worthwhile, and you get identified. Next thing you know, you can get on a staff. And, I mean, you have to be pretty good, and you got to take it serious. But there's a lot of opportunities out there right now.
The question I have, and this is something that I've talked about with Paul Barrazzo in a global way, is if there is a LeBron James of officiating out there, how do we find him or her and move them along? That's a question for a different podcast.
Yeah, we can do that on the next podcast. That's a good question.
You know, what is and is the system set up for that? We'll get to that. You had one other thing you wanted to mention in our last couple of minutes here. There was a lawsuit that college basketball official John Higgins filed against Kentucky Sport Radio for distributing his contact information. That lawsuit had been dismissed, I think, a year ago, and it's back in the news.
It is back in the news, and there's a District 6, wherever that is, has agreed to hear it from each party, and it came about because John Higgins's lawyers appealed the judge's decision to dismiss it. I'm not sure John Higgins will ever get any satisfaction from it. He has spent quite a bit of his own money to fight this, but he feels as though he's been damaged. His reputation has been damaged. His business has cost his business income, and he wants to move it forward. And he's found a place to. Now, that'll be decided very shortly in a one-day presentation. It won't be a lengthy thing, and the judge will decide whether it's worth moving forward. But he did get a chance to appeal his decision.
Well, I'll tell you what courtroom he should try to get that case into.
And that is?
Our friend, the Honorable Judge Hornacek.
Yeah.
Great. Pittsburgh.
I'm going to write that down and see if John will follow up on that one. That's a pretty good point. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank the judge. I want to thank Alvin Yellow Owl, Justin Finger, Jay Hemphill. Thank you very much for your questions. John, thank you as always for sitting down with us here in our palatial North Raleigh studio. Thanks for the coffee. Thanks for the crumble. Blueberry crumble. It's good. Thank you to Dorothy as always for setting everything up. And again, send in your questions. We'll take a look at them. We're getting close to the conference tournaments, getting close to the NCAA tournament, Selection Sunday. It's going to be a lot to talk about. Are you going to do anything official this year during the postseason?
No, I haven't been asked to do anything, but I think I'll take a day or two and maybe go up and see the semifinals in the finals since they're here in Greensboro. I'd like you to do something for me for the next time, Luke, that I didn't get to today. It seems like we are having so many close games. I'd like to know as far as conference games, if you could have your people check out.
John. is me.
How about the News and Observer people?
That's me. That's me in an afternoon of Ken Palm is what that
is. How many games have been decided like 5 or 4 points or less conference games?
I'll look into it.
So that's not you don't have a staff of people?
How long have you known me? staff of one over here, John. Unless someone wants to volunteer, we don't have a research team and we don't have a sponsor to hire one.
I'm mistaken. I thought you had a group of researchers.
Yeah, I got a team of thousands behind the scenes here, as you could tell from the quality of our production. John, thank you, everyone. Thank you for listening. And we'll be back ahead of the conference tournaments to take a look at the postseason. Thanks very much.
Okay.